engine and climb out of the car. I'm sorry, but some people are saying he probably up and left the country. But he wouldn't do that, and he wouldn't worry us like this. If we knew. I feel a strong urge to confess to her, to tell her what happened to her brother, so that she won't have to go through life wondering. I think up the words in my head. Sorry, my sister stabbed him in the back, and I masterminded throwing his body in the water. I think of how it would sound. I think of what would happen after. Look, I really... Beju... Beju's head snaps up to see my sister coming down the drive. What are you doing here? Ayola asks. You're the one who saw him last. I know there's something you're not saying. Tell me what happened to my brother. Ayola is wearing dungarees. She's the only person I know who can still pull those off. And she's licking ice cream, probably from the parlor around the corner. She pauses the licking, not because she is moved by Beju's words, but because she is aware that it is proper to pause whatever one is doing when in the presence of someone who is grieving. I spent 3 hours explaining that particular etiquette to her one Sunday afternoon. You think he's dead? Asked Ayola in a low, soft voice. Beju starts weeping. It is as though Ayola's question knocks down a dam that she has been doing her best to keep up. Her cries are deep and loud. She gulps in air and her body shudders. Ayala takes another lick of the ice cream, and then she pulls Beju into an embrace with her free arm. She rubs Beju's back as she cries. It'll be all right. It'll be all right in the end, Ayala murmurs to her. Does it matter who Beju is getting comfort from? What's done is done. So what if it is only her brother's killer who can talk candidly about the possibility of his death? Beju needed to be released from the crushing burden of hope that Femi could still be alive and Ayola was the only one willing to do it. Ayola continues to pat Beju on her back as she stares resignedly at the ice cream, the one she can no longer lick, as it drips onto the road. Secret. Korede, can I talk to you for a sec? I nod and follow Tade into his office. As soon as the door is shut, he beams at me. My face flushes and I cannot help but smile back. He looks particularly good today. He has recently had his hair cut. He is usually quite conservative with his hair, trimming it down almost to the scalp. But he has been growing it out recently, and now he has a short back and sides with the middle left an inch high. It suits him. I want to show you something, but you have to promise to keep it a secret. Okay? Promise. I promise I'll keep it a secret. He hums as he goes to his drawer and fishes something out. It is a box. A ring box. Who? I squeak, as if there was ever any doubt who the ring was for and who it isn't for. Do you think she'll like it? The ring is a 2-carat princess-cut diamond with a precious stone setting. You would have to be blind not to like it. You want to propose to Ayola, I state, so we are all on the same page. Yes. Do you think she'll say yes? Finally, a question I don't know the answer to. I blink back hot tears, and I clear my throat. Isn't this too soon? When you know, you know. You'll understand one day, Korede, when you're in love. I surprise myself by laughing. It starts off as a gasp, then a giggle, then uncontrollable tear-jerking laughter. Tade is staring at me, but I can't stop. When I finally calm down, he asks, what's so funny? Tade, what do you like about my sister? Everything. But if you had to be specific, well, she's really special. Okay, but what makes her special? She's just so... I mean, she's beautiful and perfect. I never wanted to be with someone this much. I rub my forehead with my fingers. He fails to point out the fact that she laughs at the silliest things and never holds a grudge. He hasn't mentioned how quick she is to cheat at games or that she can hemstitch a skirt without even looking at her fingers. He doesn't know her best features or her darkest secrets, and he doesn't seem to care. Put your ring away, Tade. What? This is all... I perch on his desk and try to find the words. This is all just fun and games to her. He sighs and shakes his head. People change, Koide. I know she cheated on me and all that, but that's because she hasn't known real love, and that's what I can give her. She'll hurt you. I go to put my hand on his shoulder, but he shrugs me off. I can handle... How can a man be so obtuse? The frustration I feel is like a gas bubble in my chest. I cannot control the need to burp. No, I mean it. She will hurt you, physically. She has hurt people, guys, before. I try to illustrate my point with my hands, strangling thin air. There is a moment of silence while he considers what I've said, and I consider the fact that I said it. I drop my hands. I should stop talking now. I have told him as much as I can. He's on his own from here. Is it because you don't have someone? He asks. Excuse me? Why don't you want Ayola to move forward in life? It's like you want her to depend on you for the rest of her days. He shakes his head in disappointment, and I have to check every urge to scream. I dig my nails into my palm. I never held Ayola back. If anything, I've given her a future. It's like you don't want her to be happy. She's killed before, I shout, regretting the words as soon as I have uttered them. Tade shakes his head again, marveling at how low I am willing to stoop. She told me about the guy who died. Said you blamed her for it. I'm tempted to ask him which guy he's referring to, but I can see that this is a battle that I cannot win. I lost before I even knew it had started. Ayola may not be here, but Tade is like a puppet speaking her words. Look, his voice softens as he changes tack. She really wants your approval, and all she gets from you is judgment and disdain. She lost someone she loved, and all you do is make her feel responsible. I would never have thought you could be so cruel. I thought I knew you, Koride. No, you know nothing about me or the woman you're about to propose to. And by the way, Ayola would never wear a ring less than 3 carats. He stares at me as though I'm speaking another language, the ring box still clutched in his hand. What a waste of time this all was. I glance at him over my shoulder as I open the door. Just watch your back. She had warned me. He isn't deep. All he wants is a pretty face. Friend. As I approach the reception desk, Yinka looks up from her phone. Oh good, it's you. I was afraid I would have to come and find you. What do you want? Excuse you. I don't want anything, but Koma guy has been asking for you nonstop. His name is Mutar. Whatever. Yinka leans back and resumes playing Candy Crush. I turn on my heel and make my way to room 313. He is sucking on an agbalumo, sitting in one of the armchairs. Another nurse must have set him up there for a change of scenery. He smiles when I walk in. Hello. Hi. Please sit. I can't really stay long. I'm not in the mood for chatting. My conversation with Tade is still ringing in my ears. Sit. I sit. He looks much better. His hair has been cut, and he appears to put on a bit of weight. His color looks better, too. I tell him as much. Thank you. It's a wonder what being conscious can do for one's health. He laughs at himself, then stops. Are you okay? You look a bit pale. I'm fine. What can I help you with, Mr. Yautai? Please, there's no need for formalities. Call me Muta. Okay. He stands up and grabs a paper bag off the coffee table. He hands it to me. Popcorn with syrup drizzled all over it. It looks delicious. You didn't have to do this. I wanted to. It's the least I can do to thank you. The hospital does not allow us to accept gifts from patients, but I do not want to offend him by rejecting his attempt at gratitude. I thank him, take the bag, and set it to one side. I've been thinking some more about my memories, and some things are a little clearer to me, he begins. Honestly, I am too tired for this. I can take only so much in a day. Perhaps he'll remember everything I told him, including where the bodies are, and it will be all over. Let's say, for argument's sake, that one knew someone who had committed a gross crime. Someone dear to one. What would you do? He pauses. I sit back in my chair and appraise him. I must choose my words wisely, since I have carelessly given the man the tools he needs to have my sister and me thrown into jail, and I have no idea what his angle is. One would be duty-bound to report it. One would be, yes, but most of us wouldn't, would we? Wouldn't we? No, because we are hardwired to protect and remain loyal to the people we love. Besides, no one is innocent in this world. Why go up to your maternity ward, all those smiling parents and their newborns? Murderers and victims, every one of them. The most loving parents and relatives commit murder with smiles on their faces. They force us to destroy the person we really are. A subtle kind of murder. That's quite... I can't complete the sentence. The words trouble me. It's a quote from Jim Morrison. I cannot lay claim to such wisdom. He continues to suck on the agbalumo. He's quiet, waiting for me to speak. Are you going to tell anyone about this? I doubt the words of a coma patient hold much water out there. He gestures with his thumb to the door that separates us from the world outside. Neither of us says anything. I focus on slowing down my heart rate. Without my permission, tears run down my face. Muta keeps mum. He allows me the time to appreciate that there is someone who knows what I'm dealing with, that there is someone on my side. Muta, you know enough to have us put away forever. Why do you keep the secret? I ask him as I wipe my face dry. He sucks on another agbalumo and winces at the sharpness of the flavor. Your sister, I do not know. I hear from your colleagues that she is very lovely, but I have not seen her for myself, and so do not care about her. You, I know. He points to me. You, I care about. You don't know me. I know you. I woke up because of you. Your voice calling to me. I still hear you in my dreams. He's waxing lyrical. I feel like I'm in another dream. I'm afraid, I say in the barest of whispers. Of what? The guy she's with now. She might. So save him. Father. The day before the day it all ended was a Sunday. The sun was merciless. All the air conditioners in the house were on full blast, but I could still feel the warmth from outside. Sweat was beating on my forehead. I sat under one of the air conditioners in the upstairs sitting room with no intention of moving. That is, until Ayola came scrambling up the stairs and found me. Dad has a guest. We leaned over the balcony to spy on the man. The agbada he wore kept slipping down his arms, so he was constantly pushing it back up again. It was a rich blue, and so large that it was near impossible to tell if there was a slim man or a fat man within the yards of fabric. Ayola pantomimed pushing her own sleeves back up, and we sniggered. We were not afraid of our father when he had guests. He was always on his best behavior. We could laugh and play with little fear of retribution. The guest looked up at us and smiled. His face is forever etched in my mind. It was a square, black, much blacker than I am, with teeth so white he had to have kept his dentist on speed dial. I imagine him getting shaki stuck between his back molars and then immediately demanding to be wheeled in for orthodontic surgery. The thought tickled me, and I shared it with Ayola, who laughed out loud. It caught my father's attention. Korde, Ayola, come and greet my guest. We trooped down obediently. The guest was already seated, and my mother was offering him delicacy after delicacy. He was important. We knelt down, as was customary, but he waved us back to our feet. I am not the old, he cried. He and father laughed, even though we could not see what was funny. My feet were hot and itching, and I wanted to go back to the cool of the air conditioner, I switched from foot to foot, hoping my father would dismiss us so that the men could talk business. But Ayola was transfixed by the visitor's cane. It was studded from top to bottom with different colored beads. Its brightness drew her eye and she went closer to examine it. The man paused and watched my sister over the rim of his teacup. Seeing her up close, he smiled. But it was not the same smile he had lavished on us earlier.
Your daughter is very beautiful.
Really? My father replied, cocking his head.
Very, very lovely.
He moistened his lips. I grabbed Ayola's hand and pulled her a couple of steps backward. The man looked like a chief, and when we went to the village for Christmas, our maternal grandparents always kept us away from the chiefs. Apparently, if a chief saw a girl he liked, he would reach out and touch her with his bejeweled cane and she would become his bride, no matter how many wives the man already had, no matter if the girl in question wanted to be his wife or not.
Hey, what are you doing?
Ayola whined. I hushed her. My father shot me a dark look but said nothing. The way the visitor was eyeing her triggered an instinctive fear inside of me. The visitor's face was moistening with sweat, but even as he wiped his brow with his handkerchief, his eyes did not leave Ayola's. I waited for father to put the man in his place. Instead, father leaned back and stroked the beard that he took great pains to maintain. He looked at Ayola, as though seeing her for the first time. He was the one man who never referred to Ayola's stunning features. He treated us both exactly the same. I was never given the impression he was even aware of how gorgeous she was. Ayola shifted under his gaze. He rarely looked at us closely, and when he did, it never ended well. She stopped resisting my grip and allowed me to pull her to me. Father redirected his gaze to the chief man. His eyes twinkled. Girls, leave us. We didn't need to be told twice. We ran out of the main living room and shut the door behind us. Ayola started running up the stairs, but I pressed my ear against the door.
What are you doing? She hissed. If he catches us...
Shh. I caught words floating through the door. Words like contract, deal, girl. The doors were thick oak, so I couldn't hear much else. I joined Ayola on the stairs, and we went to my room. By the time the sun went down, we were out on the balcony, watching the man get into the back seat of his Mercedes and be driven out of our compound. The fear that had been stuck in my throat receded, and I forgot about the incident with the chief man. Family. Muta and I are talking about the blandness of the food here, the coarseness of the sheets, and tall tales of his past students. There is a knock, and Muhammad enters the room, interrupting us. He mumbles a greeting to me, then beams at Mutar, greeting him in Hausa, to which Mutar enthusiastically responds. I did not realize they had made each other's acquaintance, and I have never seen Muhammad smile so freely at someone other than the nurses who fight over him. Their barrage of Hausa relegates me to the position of other, and 5 minutes in, I decide to leave. But before I have a chance to announce my intentions, there is yet another knock on the door. One of Mutar's sons comes in, trailed by a fresh-faced girl. I do not know the names of his children. It hasn't seemed important. But I can tell this is the older one. He is taller and has a full beard. He is thin like his father. They all are, like reeds in the wind. His eyes fall on me. He's probably wondering what a nurse is doing making herself comfortable at his father's bedside, tracing the rim of an empty cup with her finger. Muhammad empties the waste basket and shuffles out. I stand up.
Good morning, Dad.
Good morning. Corday, are you leaving?
You have a guest. I nod toward his son. Mutas snorts and waves his hand.
Sani, this is Corday, the owner of the voice in my dreams. I'm sure you won't mind her staying.
The son frowns with displeasure. On closer inspection, he does not look as much like his father as I thought. His eyes are small but wide-set, so that he looks permanently surprised. He gives a stiff nod, and I sit back down.
Dad, this is Miriam, the girl I want to marry, he announces. Miriam lowers herself into a suganawa, out of respect for the man she hopes will be her father-in-law. Mutar narrows his eyes. What happened to the last one you bought to meet me? His son sighs. It is a long, dramatic sigh. It didn't work out, Dad. You've been out of it for so long. I should have left the room when I had a chance. I don't understand what that means. Hadn't I already met her parents? Miriam is still kneeling, her right palm cupping her left. The two men seem to have forgotten that she is still here. If this is the first time she is hearing of another woman, it does not seem to register. She glances up at me, her eyes empty. She reminds me of Bumi. Her face is round, and she is all curves and soft flesh. Her skin is even darker than my own. She comes close to the color black that we are all labeled with. I wonder how old she is. I have changed my mind about her dad. And the money that has been spent? It's just money. Isn't my happiness more important? This is the madness you tried to pull while I was sick. Dad, I was to begin the arrangement, and I need you to... Sunny, if you think you are getting a dime from me, you are more foolish than I thought. Miriam, your name is Miriam Abi. Get up. I apologize, but I will not sanction this marriage. Miriam stumbles to her feet and then goes to stand beside Sunny. Sunny scowls at me, as though I were somehow to blame for this turn of events. I meet his glare with a look of indifference. A man like him could never ruffle my feathers. But Mutar catches the exchange. Look at me, Sunny, not Korede. Why is she even here? This is a family matter. The truth is, I'm asking myself the same question. Why does Mutar want me here? We both look to him for an answer, but he seems to be in no hurry to provide one. I have said all I intend to say on this matter. Sunny grabs Miriam's hand and spins around, dragging her out of the room with him. Mutar closes his eyes. Why did you want me to remain here? I ask. For your strength, he replies. Sheep. After I tire of tossing and turning, I decide to go to Ayola's room. When we were young, we often slept together, and it always had the effect of calming us both. Together, we were safe. She's wearing a long cotton tee and hugging a brown teddy bear. Her knees are bent toward her stomach, and she does not stir as I slip into bed beside her. This is no surprise. Ayola wakes up only when her body has tired of sleeping. She does not dream. She does not snore. She lapses into a coma that even the likes of Mutar cannot fathom. I envy her for this. My body is exhausted, but my mind is working overtime, remembering and plotting and second-guessing. I am more haunted by her actions than she is. We may have escaped punishment, but our hands are no less bloody. We lie in our bed in relative comfort even as Femi's body is succumbing to the water and the fish. I am tempted to shake Ayola awake, but what good would it do? Even if I succeeded in rousing her, she would tell me that it would all be fine and promptly go back to sleep. Instead, I count. Sheeps, ducks, chickens, cows, goats, bush rats, and corpses. I count them to oblivion. Father. Ayola had a guest. It was the summer holidays, and he had come in the hope of making her his girlfriend before school resumed. I think his name was Ola. I remember he was gangly, with a birthmark that discolored half his face. I remember he could not keep his eyes off Ayola. Father received him well. He was offered drinks and snacks. He was coaxed into talking about himself. He was even shown the knife. As far as Allah was concerned, our father was a generous, attentive host. Even Mum and Ayola had been fooled by the performance. They were both smiling. But I was on the edge of my seat, my fingernails dug into the upholstery. Allah knew better than to tell the father of the girl he wanted to date that he was interested in her. But you could see it in the way he kept glancing at Ayola, how he angled his body toward her, how he constantly said her name. This boy is a smooth talker, father announced with a chuckle, after Ayola made some well-meaning comment about helping the homeless to find work. I'm sure you are popular with the ladies. Yes, sir. No, sir, he stammered, caught off guard. You like my daughters, eh? They are lovely, eh?
Ola blushed. His eyes darted to Ayola again. Father's jaw clenched. I looked around me, but Ayola and my mother had not noticed. I remember wishing that I had taught Ayola some type of code. I coughed.
Bele, mother told me in her soothing voice.
I coughed again. Go on, drink water. I coughed once more, nothing.
Ayola, follow me, I mouthed, my eyes wide.
No thanks.
Follow me now, I hissed. She crossed her arms and looked back at Ola. She was enjoying his attention too much to mind me. Father turned his head in my direction and smiled. Then I followed his eyes to the cane. The cane lay 10 inches above the TV on a specially crafted ledge, and there it stayed all day, every day. My eyes were constantly drawn to it. To the uninitiated, it must have looked like a work of art, a nod to history and culture. It was thick, smooth, and marked with intricate carvings. The visit passed slowly until Father decided it was over, guiding Ola to the door, telling him to come again and wishing him luck. Then he walked across the silent living room and reached for the cane.
Ayola, come here.
She looked up, saw the cane, and trembled. Mother trembled. I trembled.
Are you deaf? I said come here.
But I did not ask him to come, she whined, instantly understanding what the matter was. I didn't invite him.
Please, sir, please, I whispered. I was already crying, please.
Ayola, she stepped forward. She had started crying too.
Strip.
She removed her dress, button by button. She did not hurry. She fumbled. She cried. But he was patient.
Nitori Olorun, came there, please. Nitori Olorun.
Because of God, Mother begged. Because of God. Ayola's dress fell in a pool at her feet. She was wearing a white training bra and white panties. Even though I was older, I still had no use for a bra. Mother was clinging to Father's shirt, but he brushed her off. She was never able to stop him. I took a bold step forward and took Ayola's hand in my own. History had shown me that if you came within reach of the cane would not distinguish between victim and observer. But I had a feeling Ayola would not survive the confrontation without me.
So, I am sending you to school to sleep around, Abby.
You hear the sound of a cane before you feel it. It whips the air. She cried out, and I shut my eyes.
I am paying all that money for you to be a prostitute. Answer me now.
No, sir.
We didn't call him daddy. We never had. He was not a daddy, at least not in the way the word daddy denotes. One could hardly consider him a father. He was the law in our home.
You think you're all that, Abby? I will teach you who is all that.
He struck her again. This time the cane grazed me too. I sucked in my breath.
You think this boy cares about you? He just wants what is between your legs, and when he is done, he will move on.
Pain has a way of sharpening your senses. I can still hear his heavy breathing. He was not a fit man. He quickly tired during a beating, but he had a strong will and a stronger desire to instill discipline. I can still remember the smell of our fear, acidic, metallic, sharper even than the smell of vomit. He continued to give his sermon as he wielded his weapon. Ayola's skin was light enough that you could see that it was turning red. Because I was not the target, the cane would only occasionally catch me on my shoulder or ear or the side of my face, but even so, the pain was hard to bear. I could feel Ayola's grip on my hand weakening. Her cries had turned into a low whimpering. I needed to act.
If you beat her anymore, she will scar and people will ask questions.
His hand stilled. If there was one thing in the world he actually cared about, it was his reputation. He seemed momentarily uncertain of what to do next, but then he wiped the sweat off his brow and returned the cane to its resting place. Ayola sank to the floor beside me. Not long after, when we were back at school, Ola approached me during break to deliver his thoughts about my father.
Your dad is really cool, he told me. I wish my dad was like him.
As for Ayola, she never spoke to Ola again. Wife.
If you don't like these shoes, I have more in storage. I can send you pictures.
Bumi and I look down at the avalanche of shoes that Chi-Chi has poured onto the floor behind the nurse's station. Her shift has been over for at least 30 minutes. She has changed her clothes, and apparently her profession too. She's gone from nurse to saleswoman. She bends over, shuffling through the shoes on the floor to find the ones we just have to buy. She bends over so far that we see her ass crack appear above her jeans. I avert my eyes. I was minding my own business, scheduling in a patient, when she stuck a pair of black pumps under my nose. I had waved her away, but she insisted that I come and check out her merchandise. The thing is, all the shoes she's selling look cheap, the type that fall apart after a month. She hasn't even bothered to polish them, and now they are lying on the floor. I force a smile onto my face.
You know they haven't paid salaries yet.
And I just bought a couple of new shoes, Bumi joins in.
Chi-Chi squares her shoulders and wiggles a pair of diamante heels at us.
You can never have too many shoes. My prices are very reasonable.
She's just about to launch into a sales pitch for a pair of 9-inch wedges when Yinka runs to us and slams her palms down on the counter. She may not be my favorite person in the world, but I am grateful for the interruption.
There is drama in the coma man's room. Drama ke.
Chi-Chi forgets her shoes and rests her elbow on my shoulder as she leans forward. I resist the urge to swipe her arm away.
Eh? I was going to see my patient, and I heard shouting coming from his room.
He was shouting? I ask her.
It's the wife who's shouting. I stopped to make sure he was okay, and I heard her calling him the devil, that he cannot take his money to the grave with him.
Hey, I hate stingy men.
Chi-Chi repeatedly snaps her fingers over her head, warding off any stingy man who might be tempted to come near her. I open my mouth to defend Muta, to tell them that he doesn't have a stingy bone in his body, that he is generous and kind. But I look at Bumi's dull eyes, Chi-Chi's thirsty ones, and Yinka's dark pupils, and I know that my words would be willfully misinterpreted. Instead, I stand up quickly, and Chi-Chi stumbles,
"Where are you going?"
We can't allow our patients to be harassed by friends or family. As long as they are here, they are in our care, I call back to her.
You should put that on a bumper sticker, yells Yinka.
I pretend I haven't heard her, and I take the steps, two at a time. There are 30 rooms on the third floor, 301 to 330. I hear the shouting as soon as I am in the corridor. There's a nasal voice of the wife, and a man's voice too. It is whining and cajoling, so I know it is not Muta. I knock on the door, and the voice is quiet.
Come in,
Muta calls out wearily. I open the door to find him standing by the bed, wearing a gray jalabia. He grips one of the handrails, and I can see he is half-leaning on it. The strain on his body shows on his face. He looks older than the last time I saw him. His wife is draped in a red lace mayafi. It covers her hair and falls over her right shoulder. Her dress is tailored from the same material. Her skin glows, but the snarl on her face is like that of a beast's. Mutar's brother, Abdul, stands beside her with his eyes cast down. I suppose he's the owner of the whiny voice.
Yes?
The wife barks at me.
I ignore her. Mutar?
I'm okay, he reassures me.
Would you like me to stay?
What do you mean, would he like you to stay? You are a common nurse. Come on, get out of here.
Her voice is like nails on a blackboard.
Did you hear me?
She screeches. I walk over to Mutar, and he gives me a wan smile. I think you should sit down, I tell him gently. He loosens his grip on the bar, and I help him settle into the chair closest to him. I lay his blanket over his lap. Do you want them to stay? I whisper.
What is she saying to him?
The wife splutters behind me.
She's a witch. She has used juju to useless my husband. She's the reason why he's not making sense. Abdul, do something. Send her out.
She points at me.
I will report you. I don't know what black magic you are using.
Muta shakes his head. And that is all the sign I need. Madame, please leave. Or I will have to have security escort you out. Her lower lip trembles and her eyes twitch.
Who do you think you are talking to? Abdul!
I turn to Abdul. but he doesn't lift his eyes to meet mine. He's younger than Mutar, and maybe even taller, but it is hard to tell, for he has bent his head so low that it threatens to fall off his neck. He rubs her arm in an attempt to soothe her, but she shrugs him off. To be honest, I'd shrug him off too. The suit he is wearing is expensive, but the fit is poor. It is too wide at the shoulders and too broad at the chest. It could easily belong to someone else, the way the woman whose arm he rubs belongs to someone else. I look at her again. She may have been beautiful once, maybe the first time Mutar laid eyes on her. I do not mean to be rude, I tell her, but my patient's well-being is my priority, and we don't allow anyone to jeopardize that.
Who do you think you are? You think you will get money from him? Abi, has he already given you money? Muta, you are there acting all high and mighty, and now you are chasing a nurse, see you. You could not even pick a fine one.
Get out, the order comes from Mutar, and makes us all jump. There's an authority to his voice I have not heard before. Abdul raises his head and quickly lowers it again. The wife glowers at us both before turning on her heel and marching out the door, with Abdul following limply behind. I drag a chair over and sit beside Mutar. His eyes are heavy. He pats one of my hands. Thank you. It was you who got them out, he sighs. Apparently, Miriam's father wants to run for governor of Kano State. So your wife wants you to approve the union?
Yes.
And will you?
Would you?
I think of Tade, ring in hand, eyes on me waiting for my blessing. Are they in love?
Who?
Miriam and your son.
Love. What a novel concept.
He closes his eyes. Night. Tade stares at me, but his eyes are empty. His face is bloated, distorted. He reaches out to touch me, and his hands are cold. You did this. Broken. I slither inside Tade's office and rummage through his desk drawers to retrieve the ring box. Tade has taken a patient to radiology, so I know I'm alone. The ring is as enchanting as I remember. I am tempted to slip it on my finger. Instead, I grip the band tightly, kneel on the floor, and strike the diamonds against the tile. I use every ounce of force in my body and strike again. I guess it's true that diamonds are forever. It withstands my every attempt to break it, but the rest of the ring is not as strong-willed. Soon the setting is in pieces on the ground. The diamond looks smaller and less impressive without its casing. It occurs to me that if I just damage the ring, Tade will suspect me. I slip the diamond in my pocket. After all, no self-respecting thief would leave it here. Besides, this would all be a colossal waste of time if Tade simply bought another setting. I head to the medicine cabinet. 20 minutes later, Tade storms toward the reception desk. I hold my breath. He looks at me and then quickly looks away, addressing Ginka and Bumi instead. Someone's turned my office upside down and destroyed some of my things.
What?
We cry in unison.
Are you serious?
Adds Ginka. Though it is clear from Tade's furrowed brows that something is not right. We follow him to his office and he flings open the door. I try to look at it from the eyes of an objective party. It appears as though someone was searching for something and then lost control. The drawers are all open and most of the contents scattered on the floor. The medicine cabinet is ajar, the pill bottles are in disarray, and there are files scattered all over his desk. When I left, the broken ring setting was on the ground, but I can no longer see it. This is terrible, I mumble.
Who would do this?
Bumi asks, frowning. Yinka presses her lips together and claps her hands.
I saw Mohammed go inside to clean earlier on, she reveals, and I rub my tingling hands on my thighs.
I don't think Mohammed would, begins Tade.
When you left your office, it was normal, yes?
Interrupts Yinka.
Yes. Then you went to do the x-ray and the ECG with a patient. How long were you gone?
About 40 minutes.
Well, I saw Mohammed go into your office in that time. Let's say he spent 20 minutes sweeping the floor and emptying the dustbin. It doesn't give anyone else enough time to enter, do all this and leave, concludes Yinka, the amateur detective.
Why do you think he would do this, I ask. She can't hang him without a motive, can she?
Drugs, obviously, she states.
She crosses her arms, satisfied that she has made her case. It's easy to point the finger at Mohammed. He is poor, uneducated. He is a cleaner.
No, it is Bumi who speaks, Bumi who protests. I don't accept that. She is eyeing Yinka, and because I am beside Yinka, she is eyeing me too. Or does she suspect something? This man has been working in this place for longer than the both of you, and there has never been a problem. He wouldn't do this.
I have never seen Bumi speak so passionately or for so long. We all stare at her.
Drug addicts can hide their addiction for a long time, argues Yinka finally. He was probably suffering from withdrawal or something when these people need a hit. Who knows how long he has been stealing drugs and getting away with it?
Yinka is content with her conclusion, and Tade is deep in thought. Bumi walks away. I've done the right thing, right? I have bought Tade more time to think things through. I want to volunteer to clean up, but I know I should keep my distance.
Mohammed denies the charges vehemently, but he is fired anyway.
I can see the decision does not sit well with Tade, but the evidence, or lack of evidence, is not in Mohammed's favor. It worries me that Tade does not mention the broken ring to me. In fact, he has not sought me out at all. Hey, I say a few days later, standing in the doorway of his office. What's up? He does not look at me, but continues writing in his file.
I just wanted to check that everything is all right with you.
Yeah, everything is cool.
I didn't want to ask in front of the others, but I hope the ring wasn't stolen.
He stops writing and puts his pen down. He looks at me for the first time. Actually, Korede was.
I'm about to feign shock and commiserate when he continues.
But what is funny is that the two bottles of diazepam in the cabinet weren't. The drugs were all over the place, but the ring was the only thing that was actually taken.
Curious behavior for a drug addict.
He holds my gaze. I refuse to blink or look away. I can feel my eyeballs drying out.
Very curious, I manage.
We stare at each other for a while longer, then he sighs and rubs his face.
Okay, he says, almost to himself. Okay, is there anything else?
No, not at all.
That night, I drop the diamond into the third mainland bridge lagoon.
Phone. I have found that the best way to take your mind off something is to binge-watch TV shows. The hours pass by, and I lie in my bed stuffing my mouth with ground nuts and staring at my laptop screen. I lean forward and type in the address to Femi's blog, but my efforts are met with a 404. His blog has been taken down. He no longer exists for the online world. He can no longer exist for me. He is beyond my reach now in death, as he would have been in life. My phone vibrates, and I consider ignoring it, but I reach forward and drag it toward me. It's Ayola. My heart skips a beat. Hello?
Cordy.
Number 2. Peter.
Cordy, he's dead.
What?
He's... What the hell? What are you saying? He's... You...
She bursts into tears. Please help me.
Theater.
This is the first time I will be entering Tade's home. I imagine this moment in several different ways, but never like this. I bang on the door, and then I bang again, not caring who hears or sees as long as the door is open in time. I hear the click of the door and step back. Tade stands there, sweat rolling off his face and neck in spite of the blast of air conditioning that hits me. I push past him and look around. I see his living room. His kitchen, stairs. I don't see Ayola. Where is she?
Upstairs, he whispers.
I run up the stairs, calling out to Ayola, but she does not reply. She can't be dead. She can't be. Life without her. And if she is gone, it is my fault for saying more than I should have. I knew that this could only ever be the case. To save him, I've sacrificed her. Turn left, he says, from close behind me. I open the door, my hand is shaking. I am in his bedroom. The king-sized bed takes up a third of the room. And on the other side of it, I hear a low moan. For a moment, I'm too scared to react. She is slumped on the floor, much the same way that Femi was. Pressing her hand to her side, I can see the blood spilling through her fingers, but the knife, her knife, is still in her. She looks at me and gives me a weak smile. The irony, she says. I rush to her side. She tried to kill me. I ignore him and use the scissors in my first aid kit to cut off the bottom half of my shirt after the bandages proved too paltry to do the job. I wanted to call an ambulance, but I couldn't risk Tade talking to anyone till I got to her. I didn't take out the knife, she tells me. Good girl. I use my jacket as a pillow and help her lie down. She moans again and it feels as though someone were squeezing my heart. I take medical gloves out of the kit and slip them on. I didn't mean to hurt her. Ayola, tell me what happened. I don't really want to know what happened, but I need her to keep talking. He hit me, she begins as I cut her dress open. I did not hit her, cries Tade, the first man able to defend himself against Ayola's accusations. Then I tried to stop him and he stabbed me. She came at me with a knife out of nowhere, shit! Shut up, I tell him. You're not the one lying here bleeding out, are you? I bandage her wound with the knife still in it. If I took it out, I'd risk nicking an artery or organ. I grab my phone and call the reception desk at the hospital. Chichi picks up, and I silently thank God that Yinka's not on night shift this week. I explain to her that I'll be coming with my sister who has been stabbed, and I ask her to call in Dr. Akigbe. I'll carry her, Tade says. I don't want him touching her, but he is stronger than I am. Fine. He scoops her up and brings her down the stairs and out onto the drive. She rests her head against his chest as though they were somehow still lovers. Perhaps she cannot yet understand the gravity of what has taken place here. I open the rear door of my car and he lays her in the back. I jump in the driver's seat. He tells me he will follow us in his car, and since I can't do anything to stop him, I nod. It's 4 a.m., so traffic is sparse and there are no police officers in sight. I take full advantage of this, driving 130 kilometers an hour on one-way roads. We get to the hospital in 20 minutes. Chichi and the drama team meet us at the entrance. What happened? Chichi asks, while two porters slide my little sister out onto a gurney. She's no longer conscious. What happened? She insists. She got stabbed. By who? Dr. Kigbeg materializes as we are halfway through the corridor. He checks Ayola's pulse and then barks orders at the nurses. As my sister is wheeled away, he ushers me into a side room. Can't I go in with her? Korede, you're going to have to wait outside. But you know the rules, and you've done all you can do for the moment. You requested me, so trust me. He sweeps out of the room and into the surgical theater. I walk into the hallway, just as Tade runs up, breathless. Is she in theater? I don't respond. He reaches out to touch me. Don't. He drops his hand. You know, I didn't mean to do it, right? We were both struggling with it and I turn my back on him and head to the water dispenser. He follows me. You said yourself that she's dangerous. I'm quiet. There isn't anything to say anymore. Did you tell anyone what happened? He asks in a quiet voice. No, I say, pouring a cup of water. I'm surprised at how steady my hand is, and you're not going to either. What? If you say anything about any of this, I will tell them that you attacked her, and who do you think they will believe, you or Ayola?
You know I'm innocent. You know I was defending myself.
I know I walked in, and my sister had a knife in her side. That's all I know.
She tried to kill me. You can't...
He blinks at me, as though seeing me for the first time.
You're worse than she is.
Excuse me?
There's something wrong with her, but you, what's your excuse?
He walks away from me then in disgust. I sit in the corridor outside the operating theater and wait for news.
Wound. Dr. Kigbe comes out of the room and smiles at me. I breathe out.
Can I see her?
She is sleeping. We are going to take her to a room upstairs. Once she is settled, you can pop in.
They put Ayola in room 315, two doors away from Mutar, who has never seen my sister but knows more about her than I ever intended. She looks innocent, vulnerable. Her chest rises and falls gently. Someone has laid her dreads carefully beside her on the bed.
Who did this to her?
It is Yinka. She looks upset. I'm just glad she is okay.
Whoever did this should be killed.
Her face has contorted into a mixture of fury and contempt.
If it wasn't for you, she probably would have died.
I...
Ayola!
My mom rushes in, her heart in her mouth.
My baby!
She leans over the bed and lowers her cheek to her unconscious daughter's mouth to feel her breath like she used to do sometimes when Ayola was still a baby. When she straightens, she is crying. She stumbles into me, and I put my arms around her.
Yinka excuses herself. Korede, what happened? Who did this?
She called me. I came to get her from where she was. She had the knife in her.
Where did you pick her up from?
Ayola moans, and we both turn to look at her, but she is still sleeping, and she quickly settles back into the task of breathing in and out. I'm sure Ayola will be able to tell us both what took place when she gets up.
But where did you find her? Why won't you tell me?
I wonder what Tade is doing, what he is thinking, and what his next move will be. I will Ayola to wake so that we can agree on whatever story needs to be told. Anything but the truth. She was at Tade's house. I believe he found her there like that.
Tade, was there a break-in? Could Tade have done it?
I don't know, Mom. I suddenly feel exhausted.
We'll ask Ayola when she wakes.
Mom frowns, but says nothing. All we can do now is wait.
Fence.
The hospital room is tidy, mostly because I have been setting it to rights for the past 30 minutes. The teddy bears I brought from home are arranged at the foot of the bed according to color. Yellow, brown, black. Ayola's phone is fully charged, so the charger has been wrapped around itself and placed in her bag, which I took the liberty of also rearranging. Her bag was a mess. Used tissue, receipts, cookie crumbs, notes from Dubai, and candy that had been sucked and rewrapped. I take a pen and write down the things I have thrown away in case she asks.
Korede.
I pause what I'm doing and look at Ayola, whose big bright eyes are looking at me.
Hey, you're awake. How do you feel?
Like hell. I stand up and fetch her a cup of water. I hold it to her lips and she drinks. Better?
A little. Where's Mom?
She went home to have a shower. She should be back soon. Ayola nods and then closes her eyes. She is asleep again within the minute. The next time Ayola wakes, she is more alert. She looks around, taking in her surroundings. I don't believe she has ever been in a hospital room before. She never has anything worse than the common cold, and everyone close to her has died before they reach the hospital.
It's so boring.
Would you like someone to paint graffiti on the walls for you, oh great one?
No, not graffiti. Art.
I laugh, and she laughs with me. There is a knock on the door, but before we say a word, the door opens. It's the police. A different pair from the ones who questioned us about Femi. One of them is a woman. They make a beeline for Ayola, and I block them.
Excuse me, can I help you?
We understand that she was stabbed.
Yes.
We just want to ask a few questions. Find out who it was, replies the woman, looking over my shoulder while I try to hustle them out.
It was Tade, says Ayola.
Just like that. It was Tade. She doesn't pause or hesitate. They could have asked her what the weather was, and she wouldn't have sounded more relaxed. The floor is unsteady beneath me, and I grab onto a chair and sit down.
And who is this Tade?
He's a doctor here, my mom adds, materializing as though from thin air. She looks at me strangely, probably trying to understand why I look like I'm about to throw up. I should have talked to Ayola as soon as she woke up the first time.
Can you tell us what happened?
He proposed to me, and I said I wasn't interested, and he lost it. He attacked me.
How did your sister get to you?
He left the room, and I called her. They glance at me, but they don't ask me any questions, which is good because I doubt that I would be very coherent.
Thank you, ma'am. We'll be back.
They run out, no doubt to locate Tade.
Ayola, what are you doing?
What do you mean? What is she doing?
That man stabbed your sister.
Ayola nods fervently, as outraged as our mother. Ayola, listen to me. You will ruin that man's life. It's him or me, Cordy.
Ayola,
you can't sit on the fence forever. Screen. The next time I see Mutar's wife, she's leaning against the wall of the corridor. Her shoulders are trembling, but no sound escapes her lips. Did no one tell her it is painful to cry silently? She senses she is not alone, her shoulders still, and she looks up. Her eyes narrow, and her lips twist into a sneer, but she does not wipe the snot that is trailing from her nose to her lip. I find myself taking a few steps backward. Grief can be contagious, and I have enough problems of my own. She hitches up her dress and pushes past me in a flurry of lace and a fog of Jimmy Choo low. She's careful to catch me with the sharp point of her bony shoulder. I wonder where her brother-in-law is and why he's not by her side. I try not to breathe in the pungent smell of perfume and sadness as I head to room 313. Mutar is seated on his bed, with the remote control pointed at the TV. He puts it down when he sees me and flashes me a warm smile, though his eyes are tired. I saw your wife on the way here.
Oh.
She was crying.
Oh.
I wait for him to add something more, but he chooses to pick up the remote control and continue flicking through channels. He does not seem surprised or disturbed by what I've told him, or particularly interested. I may as well have told him that I saw a wall gecko on the way to work.
Did you ever love her?
Once upon a time.
Perhaps she still loves you.
She does not cry for me, he says, his voice hardening. She cries for her lost youth, her missed opportunities and her limited options. She does not cry for me, she cries for herself. He settles on a channel, NTA. It's like watching television from the 90s. The reporter has a green-gray tint, and the transmission flickers and jumps. We both stare at the screen, at the Danfo buses zooming past, and the passers-by craning their necks to take a look at what is being filmed. He's muted the sound, so I have no idea what is happening.
I heard about what happened to your sister.
News travels fast around here.
I'm sorry.
I smile at him. I suppose it was only a matter of time. She tried to hurt someone again. I don't say anything, but then he didn't phrase it as a question. On the TV, the woman has now stopped to interview a passerby, and his eyes continually flit between her and the camera, as though he is unsure whom he should be making his case to.
You can do it, you know.
Do what?
Free yourself. Tell the truth.
I can feel his gaze on me now. The TV has started to blur. I blink, blink again, and swallow. No words come out. The truth. The truth is that my sister was hurt on my watch because of something I said, and I regret it. He senses my discomfort and changes the subject. They are discharging me tomorrow. I turned to meet his eyes. He wasn't going to be here forever. He isn't a chair or a bed or a stethoscope.